Tonight, we're happy to welcome back to Many Rivers Ian Weaver, artist and author. She is known to her friends as Nina, is the original medical illustrator of the book Our Bodies, Ourselves. She's a former medical artist at UCSF and a painter and a sculptor of 40 years. She came to the craft of writing as a public school teacher and curriculum writer, receiving a small grant for developing a creative arts writing curriculum for youth with learning disabilities. And tonight, she will be talking about her novel, Bleed 3. So please, Bleed. I'm having trouble pronouncing things tonight. Bleed 3. So let's everyone welcome Ian Weaver to Many Rivers. Thank you, Ian.
Well, I had wanted to read the first chapter, but I think many of you have read the have heard the first chapter, so I may pick something else. Let me give you a little preview. This is Rita Kerner. She's kind of the main character of the story, and she grows up in a Jewish household. And this chapter is about her family. Queens, New York, 1957 to 1958. Bubala, come, it's time. Gay Schluffen, go to sleep. Pearl walked into the living room where Rita was drawing with her crayons while her parents listened to the radio. House Un-American Activities Committee convicted several writers for Un-American Activities today in its ongoing. Lily and David had settled into their new living room sofa to hear the day's news report. Lillian had already put Irene and Rita's new baby sister Tina to bed. Governor Orville Favis sent National Guard troops to prevent 9 Negro students from entering Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas today. Speaking out, Martin Luther King Jr. announced a nationwide resistance to segregation. Rita's parents listened intently. Pearl shook her head, giving her son David a disapproving glance. Rita, Bubula, come here. Come here, she urged her oldest grandchild. Gay Schlaffen, go to sleep. She pointed to the clock next to the radio. Reluctantly, Rita left her drawing of a boy on a horse. Good night, dear, Lillian said, kissing Rita's cheek. Good night, honey, David winked. It was already 9 o'clock, later than usual time for Rita and Grandma Pearl's evening ritual. Nevertheless, they went to Grandma's new room, a room all her own in a new, attached three-bedroom house where they had moved after Tina was born 2 years ago. Pearl sat at the edge of the bed so Rita could begin the nightly routine. The child took the tortoiseshell brush from atop Pearl's dresser. Carefully, she removed the combs and hairpins that held grandmother's hair up in a bun. The hair cascaded down Pearl's back. Rita let the brush glide gently through the long silver strands from atop her head to the ends that nearly touched the floor, while Pearl sat patiently, holding one section of hair at a time in her child-sized hands. Rita brushed gently to remove any knots. Usually there were none. When Rita was satisfied with its luxurious smoothness, she separated 3 equal sections and started to braid it, not too loose or too tight. This beautiful hair, her grandmother's prized possession, was almost as long as 10-year-old Rita was tall. Silky and thick, the night braid needed no fastening. As Rita held the 3 sections overlapping each in turn, she listened to grandmother's stories about her childhood in a faraway land. Pearl grew up in a shtetl, a poor Jewish village in Russia. She was a girl with long jet black hair, her hair the product of her family's Mongolian ancestry. Her family and neighbors in her village admire her hair for the money such locks brought. Each time her hair grew to waist length, it would be cut and sold for wigs. There were tears, but no questions. no disobedience, no discussion. Being the youngest of seven children and motherless since her birth, Pearl was the chosen one. She would go to America to be cared for by the oldest brother already on that land paved with gold. Each small bit of money from the sale of her hair brought her closer to safe passage, out of harm's way, to freedom. She would escape the fate that awaited those left behind. Rita never tired of listening to the tale. It was 1903. I was 12. I came by myself on that big boat. My brother, I'd never met him, came for me at Ellis Island, Grandma Pearl told Rita in broken English. I worked in a sewing factory until he arranged a marriage for me. Her voice softened. A year later, your father was born. Pearl smiled a rare smile. Rita knew her grandmother had never learned to read or write. Married at 18, a mother at 19, Pearl and her husband, the grandfather Rita never met, worked at a deli on the Lower East Side. During the Great Depression, Rita's grandfather died. Left alone, Pearl and young David moved back in with Pearl's brother and his wife. Rita knew the story by heart. I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to go on to a chapter that is kind of a place where the grandmother has gotten ill. She's growing old. 1959, a year later, 2 years later. After Grandma Pearl went to the nursing home, Rita dreamed about her often. In her dream, it was summer. They were at the beach again, romping in the shallow ocean water. When the dream shifted, Pearl was in her cooking apron, standing in the kitchen, teaching Rita to make chicken soup. Abyssal salt, a little salt, garlic, onions, celery, carrots. Pearl held up the parsnip. This makes it good, good. Grandmother poured some salt into the palm of her hand and tossed it into the boiling water. In a wooden bowl, she chopped onions, her arms jiggling as she chopped. When she was done, she brushed a few loose strands of hair off her forehead, rinsed her hands, and smiled at Rita. You know what is next, Bobby? You cut the parsnips, carrots, and celery, Rita's gleeful voice echoed in the dream. You will be a good balabusta, a good wife. Pearl smiled through Rita's winding dream. Fleeting images of herself braiding Pearl's long hair drifted in and out. Before long, another dream scene found Rita sitting with someone else who braided her hair. Rita looked over her shoulder to see a woman who resembled her mother, Lillian, combing and braiding. But Lillian looked different. Her skin was darker, her face gentler, clothes softer. Rita was not herself either, not the Rita she knew herself to be. She was a young boy with long black hair. Chucky, the woman in the dream said, you must do what your father asks. Before the dream child answered, Rita awoke. She lay still for a moment, trying to recapture the vision. Why had the woman called her by a boy's name, a name that sounded like Charlie? What had the father in the dream asked her to do? Rita reached for her art pad and pencil in the dining table drawer. She drew a picture of herself as a young boy, but not with a woman combing his hair. She drew him on a horse with his hair blowing in the wind behind him. Rita, dear, are you up? Lillian slowly opened her daughter's bedroom door. Your father wants you to go visit Pearl with him today. I have breakfast ready, she offered. Irene and Tina wanted eggs, so I made scrambled. Rita hid her pad under her pillow. Okay, eggs are fine, Mom, she said, hoping Lillian would not ask about her drawings. She got out of bed and walked to the bathroom. Lillian followed her with a fresh towel from the linen closet. I'll make some toast. Will you do what your father asks? Rita turned and looked at Lillian. What? A memory flashed by her. Your father asked you last night if you would go to Lawnview Manor with him today, remember? Lillian replied. Of course, yes, Rita said, taking the towel from Lillian. Rita closed the bathroom door. She could not stand the thought of visiting Pearl in the nursing home. but she did go with her father to visit her that morning as promised. Rita and David walked down the sterile hallway past the sad eyes of many old people who reached out for attention, for something as simple and familiar as a smile. Soon, Rita and David found Grandma Pearl's room. She sat on a bed in a dark corner, weeping. "Mom?" David called after her. Grandma Pearl looked up, but she didn't acknowledge Rita. She spoke only to her son. "Oi, Gott in Himmel, O God in heaven," she sobbed, covering her hand with her face with her hands. Rita walked closer to her. There was something unrecognizable about Grandma Pearl. Something was obviously different, yet so inconceivable that Rita's mind could not accept what she saw. They had chopped off all of her grandmother's hair. Her long, beautiful silver strands, gone. Rita gasped, tears welling up in her eyes. Her cheeks burned. She reached out to hug her grandmother, but Pearl pushed her away, still sobbing. A few days later, Rita and David returned to the nursing home. Pearl was dying. Rita stood at her grandmother's bedside as the old woman floated in and out of consciousness, not recognizing Rita. "Grandma, it's me," Rita whispered desperately. Rita wanted her to respond. She wanted grandmother to know she loved her. Rita didn't want Pearl to die without forgiving her for what surely must have been Rita's fault. She had not taken good care of her, helped her to dial the phone enough, or found a way to take her back to see her brother and friends. Was Grandma Pearl dying of loneliness or sadness? Rita blamed herself for being so intolerant toward the end. "Grandma," she pleaded. The old woman whimpered. Then Grandma Pearl's eyes glazed closed. She slept. Shortly after Rita and David returned home, the nursing home doctor phoned. Rita answered the phone. "Your mother Pearl has passed away," he said. "She went peacefully," he continued, seemingly unaware he was talking to her grandchild, not an adult. "She's dead? Peacefully?" Rita cried aghast. How dare this strange man who didn't know grandmother's suffering and courage use such a word? Rita called out for her father to pick up the phone. She ran into her room and slammed the door. At the funeral, David sat next to Lillian, who held Tina on her lap. Irene and Rita sat by her father's side. David wiped tears from his eyes. Rita put her arm around Irene, who sobbed quietly. But Rita could not cry. She was numb. It was not her grandmother Pearl lying in that casket. Pearl did not have short hair. She did not wear makeup, nor did she dress in white lace. Rita could not weep for a dead bride dressed in white with short cropped hair framing her painted face, cold in her open casket. Rita turned cold too. All she could think of was it was her fault. Had grandmother died because she betrayed her? That night, Rita slept alone in the big bed in Grandma Pearl's room. It took her a long time to fall asleep. In her dream, Rita climbed out the bedroom window onto the 3-foot ledge that framed the dormer of the sloping roof. She sat there a long time looking up at the stars. Then she stood up and jumped off the ledge. But something caught Rita as she fell. It was like a great wind, and suddenly Rita was flying over treetops, tree-lined streets, and rooftops. "Don't be afraid," a voice whispered. A flutter of white feathers appeared in her peripheral vision, a sensation of soft, goose down. Rita began to rise and swoop like a bird. Then a young man with long dark hair dressed in deerskin pants appeared on horseback. Aglow, he was almost transparent, yet visible. "Remember," he said softly, "you are the one who must remember us." Momentarily, Rita had the sensation of knowing, of understanding, of recognizing the voice, the horse, but it all vanished in an instant. Her dream evaporated as quickly as it had come. What remained was the desire to fly, to be an eagle soaring into the starry sky. She didn't want the feeling to ever end. But a chill woke her. She felt her body's weight in the pull of gravity. Semi-conscious and with her eyes still closed, she groped near her feet for a blanket. Not locating her cover, Rita peeked down at her legs, squinting in the light of a bright sunrise. Then her eyes opened wide. With a gasp, she sat up. She was perched precariously on the edge of the roof. Carefully, she moved, swinging her legs back onto the roof's ledge, maneuvering away from danger. Rita crawled back through the open window into Grandma's bedroom. She lay down in the feathered bed, still feeling the sensation of flying, still hearing familiar, comforting words. Hearing voices was not new to Rita. They had called her name since she was very young, but she could never find their source. She looked over the picture on her grandmother's dresser of a young Grandma Pearl holding little David, a toddler in the photo. Perhaps now the voices would be soothing ones, Rita thought. Maybe grandmother would talk to her from beyond, like the voice in her dream. Rita's tears slid down to her chin. She turned over and covered her head with a pillow, leaving just enough room for air. "Geh schlafen, Bubala," she heard. So, on a lighter note, although Clara Doyle is not so light either. Let's see. How are we doing? Doing okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see if we can find something pretty good here. Sorry, I don't have this planned out real well. Oh, this one's pretty good. I'm trying to find something that's not too long. Oh, this one's good. This is 1970, New York City. Rita didn't tell her parents when she dropped her classes at Hunter and started taking painting classes at the Art Students League instead. She would handle the course herself, nor did she tell them about her relationship with Beth. They would be appalled, she thought, particularly her father, David, had made such a scene about Marvin, the boy she had dated in high school, as she remembered. "Is he on something?" David asked. "His eyes are glazed. He's not Jewish, that's for sure. Is he still in high school?" "No, he's not on something. He's an artist, a songwriter, Dad," Rita lied, knowing pots and pills were part of her boyfriend's scene. Risking igniting a firestorm, she added, "Why? Just because he's black? It's not like it's important, but if you must know, his mom's white and Jewish." "Since when is race and religion important to you, anyway?" Rita could almost see the steam coming out of her father's ears, but couldn't stop herself. "I can date who I want, and it's pretty hypocritical," she added. "You and Mom have always had all kinds of friends. You have your union buddies. Mom goes to all the civil rights marches. I should only go out with someone white and Jewish?" Rita was ready for a fight, but David stormed off without another word. Had her parents become a stereotype? Did they really hope for her to marry a nice Jewish boy with plans for medical school? It's just as easy to marry a rich man as a poor man. Wasn't that just an expression they used, or was it a serious indoctrination into womanhood? The memory made Rita slightly nauseous. Recently, arguing and disagreements with her parents had become increasingly common. She tried broaching the subject on the women's movement once, but it brought her only grunt of contempt from David. Louie and they listened at first, but Rita could tell she was hesitant to rock the boat. Telling them about Beth was out of the question. Besides, things had been on and off with Beth lately. Rita had found some underwear in her lover's bedroom that didn't belong to either of them. Beth said they were hers, but Rita knew Beth wouldn't be caught dead in lace, not even black lace. So they had fought, and the yelling and the tears was not a pretty sight. Rita was hurt, staying away from Beth, licking her wounds for a while. She'd recuperate, though, maybe try again. Rita decided to immerse herself in art for now. She liked her teacher at art school, and he took an interest in her work. It meant a lot to her. Mr. Roberts was a top instructor in the painting department. She had been lucky to get into his class. "The drawing is excellent. You have a real gift for realism," Mr. Roberts said, admiring Rita's most recent painting. "Now I want you to really make your portraits come alive, like the old masters." Rita laughed nervously. She was a good artist, but the old masters, not quite, she thought. Mr. Roberts could see the self-doubt in her eyes. He was used to his students' lack of confidence. Having taught for so many years, he knew artists. Some were had overinflated egos, but the majority, the truly gifted ones, were meeker, holding on to their brilliance, their sanity, by a thread. They arrived in his class having battled through childhood trauma, filled with mean or even well-meaning adults belittling them for claiming an artistic nature, badgering them into conformity, or worse. He saw Rita's shoulders slump. He knew using the words paint like the old masters was like asking her to climb Mount Everest. Look, there's a trick to it. Well, it's more of a tried and true method, he said. Taking the varnish bottle, the one she had used after a painting was finished and well dried, he mixed a little of its contents with some clean turpentine. It's called glazing, Mr. Roberts continued. You combine some turpentine and varnish and a little paint. Use a color that is darker or lighter than what is on your canvas already. In this case, a little yellow will work, he continued. Let's concentrate on the face, the skin color. He tested the area of the canvas with a finger to judge its dryness. It's dry enough. He picked up a paintbrush, mixing a small bit of yellow with the varnish turpentine blend. Rita watched him like a hawk. What you're after here is what we call the bleed-through effect, he said. The color beneath the beige skin tone of this portrait will bleed through the yellow glaze placed over it. He began to paint as he spoke. You won't lose either color. You'll be able to see both at the same time and more. With light strokes, he brushed the glaze over the painting. Rita watched the canvas metamorphosis. The skin tone Rita used for the model's face suddenly became radiant. Subtle undertones of beige turned a light pink and orange, bringing the image to life. As if caught in that splendid moment of light that reflects the glow of a brilliant sunset. Voila! Bleed through, Mr. Roberts smiled. If he had been a woman, Rita would have thrown her arms around him and kissed him passionately. With a simple stroke of a brush, she had changed her whole outlook on life. Maybe there was nothing she couldn't try, nothing beyond her ability. All one needed was knowledge. It was like each person had a key, their very own unique key that opened doors. She felt elated with the realization, the discovery of the hidden yet logical nature of the world. Why hadn't she seen what was now so obvious? One had to find the right people, the right keys. One had to look beneath the surface, through the layers of what appeared to be reality. Rita flew home on wings of pure inspiration. She intended to paint into the wee hours of the morning all the people and places she had seen, all the visions, dreams, and stories using glazing. Bleed through, she repeated, feeling the words roll off her tongue. When she reached her apartment, she found a note tucked under the door. Still exuberant, she didn't hesitate to open it. She recognized Beth's handwriting. Perhaps a love note. An apology, she figured. Listen, kiddo, I'm really sorry. Things aren't working out. I've met someone and I'm leaving town. She lives out in the Hamptons. Always did have fantasies of a sugar mama. She's got dough, but that's not it. I mean, it's great and all, but anyway, take whatever you want from the place. If you want to have dinner before I leave, let me know. I'm moving this weekend. I'll always love you, Beth. So I'm giving you bits and pieces. Would anyone like to ask or say anything at this point? I mean, I can read a bunch of other things, but I was just wondering if you have any questions or want to know anything? No?
So where are you from? Are you from New York?
I'm from New York.
Yeah. From Queens?
I'm from the Bronx.
Bronx.
Yeah. But I've spent time in all five boroughs. Yeah. I find that it's really great when writers have been to the place that they're writing about. You know, it's one of the things that I'm struggling with in the second novel, which I'm going to give you a sneak preview of.
Nina, she had a question.
Oh, okay.
I was curious also about painting.
Yes, coming up. So how much time do I have?
You have about a half hour.
Oh, okay, great. So, so I'm going to get to that in a second. So I did this painting. This is a painting of, this actually represents one of the characters in the story. Clara Doyle. Clara Doyle. And so the whole story is about these various characters that you don't know how they're connected, and then you do. They each have a connection to Rita, the main character. And one of the things about Rita is that she is, her parents have this picture over their bed that is of this picture. And she's haunted by it. She doesn't know why she's haunted by it, but she's haunted by it. And so that's where this picture comes from. Well, and then there's another picture. So this picture is the next picture, which is going to be the cover of the next book. So I have books, I have a sequel coming next year. And this is, I don't know if you can see it. So that's the next cover. And this represents some of the characters in the story. And this painting is called Tikkun Olam, and that means repair of the world. And so it's about, when I read you some of the new books, you'll see that it's a little bit, it's a takeoff from this book. This book is more about past lives, reincarnation, things like that. And a sense of there's a way in which Rita discovers all of these things. You know, it's a journey of discovery for her as an artist. And that piece about learning glazing is her first discovery of the layers of things that happen. So then I have this other book that you get to sneak preview tonight. So it's not edited yet, so you are in luck. Or maybe not.
Does it have a title?
Well, it does, but the title is a working title. It's not a final title. It's called The Many Lives of Rita Pedini. Now, that's, you know, there's a Rita Kerner, and then there's a Rita Pedini. So now, Rita Pedini is someone who Rita Kerner has heard of. Now, Rita, this is being the sequel, you have to, they say that when you write a sequel, it has to be a standalone book, because the reader has to not have to read the first book in order to read the second book. Well, I'm struggling with that, because there's so much history in the first book. So you come into the second book without that history. But I'm trying very hard to make it work. So one of the things that you need to know about what I'm going to read is that Rita's now a middle-aged person in this book, and she keeps running into this issue where people recognize her that she doesn't know. And they keep saying, oh, hi, and they know her name, and she can't understand it. She doesn't know these people, and it keeps happening over and over again. So she and her partner are moving to California. So this is kind of a long chapter. I'll read part of it. And then I'm going to read something that's really different from a different chapter. Okay. I'm jumping around because I think it gives you sort of a picture. So she's writing to her son as they're getting ready to go. She says, Dear Noah, how are you, honey? How are you liking California? Yes.
Which Rita is this?
Now, this is Rita Kerner. We won't know. I'm never going to spill the beans on the other one. Okay. So she says, how are you liking California? Please send Kate. Now, her son Noah has moved to California before her, and Kate is his girlfriend. Please give Kate my regards. How was meeting her parents? I can't wait to hear more about your new job. And the letter goes on, and she tells him that they're coming to California They're done packing and leaving tomorrow the next day. Very exciting. I haven't traveled this beautiful land since I was your age. Yes, centuries ago. We plan to take the southern route so we can stop in Santa Fe, then on through Arizona and Southern California, driving up that amazing Pacific coast. I'm really looking forward to it. It should take us about 10 days since we'll be stopping to see Irene and our friends Donna and Sharon in Arizona. Did I tell you they bought a house in Tucson? Of course, driving Cleo's cousin's Buick is not my first choice, but we promised her we'd bring it out to L.A., and we already have a hitch for the U-Haul. Besides, the Chevy was not in shape to make the trip. I will find a decent car when I get out there, since you told me about the stricter air pollution laws. And she goes on to say how they're coming. Rita folded a check of $100 into the letter and sealed the envelope. She put Skippy on a leash and walked to the post office. Everything was ready to go, she thought. She had gone over her checklist at least a dozen times. Now all she had to do was wait for Cleo to return with the extra key for the Buick, and they would be ready. The fact that Cleo's cousin Joan had only one key, a multi-purpose door, ignition key for her old car, had delayed the start of the trip. They had tried to have another one made with no success. But today, Cleo had gone to Amherst after a promising phone call to a friend who knew a mechanic at a dealership or something. Rita didn't get the whole story. But Cleo seemed confident it was a done deal. So bright and early the next morning, off they go. Rita stopped at the market after posting her letter. She left her sunglasses on in the store lest she have some more coincidental encounters. But it didn't help. Bob and Harriet Wolke from Indiana were visiting their daughter at Smith. They were sure they knew Rita, accosting her at the checkout counter. Oh yes, sure we have met. You look familiar too. Must have been the barbecue over at What's Their Names. Rita decided to just go along with it. She thought about her standard line. I'm an old soul and I know everyone. But she didn't think Mr. and Mrs. Middle America would like that one. Then again, maybe with a daughter at Smith. That will be $22.60, the clerk interrupted. The bag boy plopped the roast, chicken, bread, chips, apples, and cookies into a brown paper bag. Oh, I forgot the gum, Rita reached for some peppermint and spearmint flavored gum. Can't have too much chewing gum for a road trip, she laughed to herself, oblivious to the clerk's annoyance, fiddling with the cash register to add her last minute item. She hurried out to Skippy, who she had left tied at the railing, as usual for market runs. A teenage boy was kneeling and petting him. The kid looked up at Rita. This your dog, he asked. I knew he looked familiar. Oh, no, now my dog also looks familiar, Rita thought. Scrutinizing the boy's face, she suddenly recognized him. Oh, yeah, she said. You're the super's nephew, Tim, right? Here visiting for the summer? Rita was happy to let him carry her bag to the apartment. Cleo was just coming up the walkway when she arrived at the front door. Hi, babe, what's the good news? She asked, hoping for a positive outcome despite the frustration telegraphed on Cleo's face. Yeah, well, no luck. We have to go with the key we have. I don't want to wait any longer, Cleo shrugged. I'm pissed, but I'm done. I called Joan and told her off. She apologized for not letting us know about the key situation. She'll pay us back for the gas and any unplanned expenses we have along the way. Hopefully we won't have any of those, Cleo brightened. So I had the car all checked out, tires, brakes, fluid, we're good to go. We'll have to be really careful not to lose the key or lock it in the car, that's all. She rolled her eyes for a minute. Leaving city traffic in the dust, Rita and Cleo headed out as planned the next morning, trailing a small U-Haul with their worldly belongings to a new life on the West Coast. They hadn't driven for more than a day when the air conditioner stopped blowing cooled air. The temperature had been climbing as they drove. They kept cool with ice water and just the fan, stopping at night in air-conditioned motels. By the time they turned onto I-44 near Tulsa, Oklahoma, though, it was over 90 degrees. Maybe it's just out of Freon. We can go to Tulsa and have it checked, Rita suggested, filling both their travel mugs and Skippy's water dish with more ice. Okay, we should stop for the night anyway. I think any decent gas station with a mechanic can check it. Early the next morning, they pulled into the first full-service station they found. You ladies traveling alone? Brad, the attendant at the Shell station, smiled a toothy grin. No, we're together, Rita and Cleo both thought of the old Hollander song. My sister and I seem to be having an air conditioning problem. Any chance you could see if we need Freon? Cleo inquired instead. Well, Dirk's out there in the garage doing an oil change. Should be able to look into your gas gal's problem in a short while. You all from New York City? Rita thought that might be code for you all Jews, but she tried to dismiss her negative thinking in spite of her insecurity about her Jewish looks and New York accent. Cleo was quick to pick up the ball, though. No, we're headed out west from Massachusetts. Oh, yeah? I got a brother lives up there in Boston. Geez, I thought you maybe looked familiar when you came in, he said, turning to Rita. You been in Boston much? I was up to see old Billy last summer at one of those big old Red Sox shindigs. Maybe you know him, Billy Wilcox. Maybe I met you at his place. Rita almost choked on her ice water. Could be, chimed Cleo. Rita here is a big Red Sox fan, aren't you, sis? Rita gave Rita a firm smack between the shoulder blades and winked. Rita, coughing, suffocated her laugh. Oh, yes, I do like my Red Sox, just like Billy and all of us in Boston, she managed. Hey, Dirk, Brad yelled, walking to the garage. Will you take a break and check these girls' car right quick? Their air conditioning ain't working. Maybe just a quick look-see, will ya? He turned back to Rita and Cleo. Don't you should have to wait too long in this heat, ladies. Shit, Cleo said as they left the gas station and headed back onto the interstate with a still broken air conditioner. That old Dirk could not fix. Half the day gone. I'm going to give that damn cousin hell. I have a mind to stay at the most expensive places we can find with air-conditioned pools, spa, room service, and give her the bill. Would be nice, but we have the dog. I've mapped out the route with the dog-friendly motels, huh? Hey, gal, you don't know old Billy Bob from them baseball shindigs. Well, he made you a big grinder for the Red Sox game, Rita chuckled. Cleo burst out laughing. Hey, watch it. Those Red Sox are cool, Cleo caught her breath. Then she turned on Janice, me and Bobby McGee as loud as the car speaker would go. Singing at the top of their voices, they both turned 25 years old again. So, this is a kind of cool part. If you want to hear some more of this, or you want me to go on and read some other things. Yeah? Okay. The next day, Reed and Cleo took turns driving and watched the land change. Still flat, there were hills in the distance. The earth turned the color of orange honey. The late afternoon air was warm as the barren landscape stretched before them in endless miles. The only sign of civilization was a faded sign along the road that featured a stereotypical 1950s housewife in an apron holding a pie. The entire sign was in shades of light blue, making her look sickly pale. Like a program from the Twilight Zone, the sign kept appearing every few miles in various conditions of weathered wear and tear with words that were partially worn off. The first one read, Mighty H. The second read, T High. Like the Jesus Saves You signs of the Bible Belt, they got the whole message at the last one. The words, Mighty High Pie, came into view for you finally above the last worn-out housewife. They both looked at each other. Pie, they drooled in unison. Nothing like sweets for curing exhaustion and hunger. They turned off the next exit to find a solitary building looking like a little French pastry restaurant. Unexpectedly charming, the white building had royal blue awnings, a freshly surfaced parking lot with crisp white lines, and two trees on either end, flowers planted around their bases. It looked as if the whole place had just appeared from the ether, brand new and shiny in an otherwise desolate, dusty landscape. Parking in the shade for Skippy Skate, they walked into the cafe. The cool, air-conditioned room lowered their blood pressure instantaneously. 20 meringue pies, each 9 inches high, covered an antique mahogany bar. The mighty white clouds of meringue reflected 10 folds in the enormous mirror behind the bar, creating a dizzying illusion of endless sugary delight. The sight almost brought them to tears. A waitress appeared immediately beside them to soothe their joyful shock. Would you like to have lunch or just pie? She asked. She was obviously ready for the almost incoherent stuttering of weary travelers entering pie heaven. Embarrassed by gluttonous rapture, Rio looked at Cleo. We should have some real food first, shouldn't we? They managed to share a chicken sandwich with lust for pie in their hearts. We'll have one slice of banana, one lemon, and one chocolate to go, please, Cleo ordered, her mouth watering. The waitress brought a box containing their pie slices, and soon they were on their way, stuffing themselves happily with forkfuls of sweet dreams. Rita was sure even Skippy smiled after his first mouthful of banana meringue pie. The next day they reached the altitude of Santa Fe. I'm going to skip this part. Okay. By afternoon, the desert was hotter than Rita and Cleo imagined. By the time they crossed into Arizona, it was 100 degrees. To make matters worse, they found they had misjudged their gas, not realizing there would be so few gas stations on the interstate. Scouring their maps, they estimated they were 200 miles from the nearest town, with nothing but desert ahead and behind of them, and a gas tank running low. Luckily, they soon came to what was advertised as a trading post. It was a run-down shack that boasted a soda machine outside and two gas pumps that unfortunately hadn't functioned in years. They pulled off the highway, hoping for gas, but all that was available aside from soda was Native and Mexican pottery, rugs, hats, small cactus plants, and postcards. Some candy bars that had seen better days were sold at the counter. The saving grace was the old couple that ran the place. They spoke enough English to communicate with Rita and Cleo about the gas station 20 miles away on the other side of the highway. It was a modern gas station with a little mart. A big picture of frozen strawberry smoothies hung in the window. Rita pulled the U-Haul lugging car alongside the gas pump in the shade of its overhang. There were no other vehicles in the station except for one 18-wheel truck with red, white, and blue pictures of Pepsi Cola painted on its side, parked in front of a pump to the right. Cleo and Rita looked at each other and began breathing again. "I'll go get us some smoothies and pay for the gas," Cleo offered. "Okay," Rita released her seatbelt. "I'll walk Skippy and pump the gas afterward." Cleo walked to the station. Rita took the key from the ignition and carefully put it in her breast pocket. Skippy was anxious to get out and walk. Even in the extreme heat, he pulled her along into the desert. They had not walked for too long before the dog relieved himself. Glad to get out of the blistering heat, Rita made a beeline back to the shaded car. Reaching into her breast pocket, she felt for the car key. At first, her mind did not compute that her pocket was empty. Patting herself down, panic rose in her throat. She checked every pocket over and over. From a distance, her frantic movements looked like she was having a seizure. Finally, Rita just stood still. She tried to focus and breathe to calm herself, go over her steps, out into the sand where she had walked with the dog, but to no avail. Back at the car again, she noticed Skippy staring out at the desert and wagging his tail. Rita squinted out to the steaming, empty landscape. Suddenly, she saw something moving. It seemed to be a person coming out of nowhere from the hazy horizon. She looked harder. It was a man. He was far away, but walking toward her. Oddly, in a matter of seconds, he was close enough to see, for her to see him clearly. His ebony skin and white dreadlocks stood out against the sun-bleached sand. Rita just stared, suspended in disbelief. The old man approached her. He smiled and held out his left hand, palm up. She didn't see his lips move, but she was sure she heard him ask, "Is this what you are looking for?" Rita looked down to see her car key shining in his wrinkled hand. Before she could comprehend what had happened, she held the key in her own hand and watched as the man simply walked away behind the big truck and out of sight. Out of the corner of her eye, Rita saw Cleo walking toward the truck also, carrying two large frozen smoothies. As if waking from a dream, Rita opened the car door and settled the dog into the back seat. She had just sat down when Cleo handed her a frozen drink. "Who is that man I saw you talking to?" Cleo asked. "I don't know," Rita whispered, startled and relieved at the same time that Cleo had also seen him, that she hadn't imagined the whole incident. "Didn't you see him when you walked behind the truck? You must have passed him." "There was nobody behind the truck," Cleo said. "I saw you talking to an old black man here for a moment next to the car, didn't I?" Yes, Rita did not know what to say. Should she tell Cleo she had lost the key? "You won't believe this, maybe, but I think maybe an angel," Rita whispered. and waited for Cleo's ridicule. You think so? Cleo said nonchalantly, sipping her icy drink. Now it was Rita that looked awry at Cleo. The heat must have fried her brain cells. Who are you and what have you done with Cleo? They both laughed as they drank their icy strawberry smoothies. You want me to drive, Louise? Cleo teased. Maybe later, Thelma. Rita smiled. She turned the precious key in the ignition, then steered the old Buick back onto the hot pavement of the interstate and headed west toward the setting sun, music blaring. Yeah. So that's getting close to the end, huh? Okay, well, thank you so much for coming. And so this is one of these is Rita, one of these is the other Rita, and then one of these is Professor Amari that I didn't get to read to you, but you'll have to buy the new book when it comes out. Thank you.